Unitarian. We're hoping to get Garland Nixon on the line soon. Garland, let us know when you are around.
I'm not far away, Havart.
Oh, you're there. Okay, you're a little slowly to get in touch there, but you're there. Great. Happy New Year to both of you, gentlemen.
Hello, Garland.
Going into this new year, I think everyone was afraid. I know all the business channels were scared to death. We were going to go over the fiscal cliff. And everyone said it would be horror for everyone. Taxes would go up. I want to talk about the fiscal cliff today with both of you and really all its aspects, because there was a fascinating history going up to the fiscal cliff. The Republican Party went through amazing turns and at what that says about the Republican Party. Then the details of the cliff. Terry, I know you've got lots and lots of details of all the goodies thrown in that were all thrown in at the last minute when no one was watching. And then I want to talk about the future, because we got several other cliffs to worry about. Everything from the debt ceiling to shutting down the national government to whether or not the sequester is actually going to go away, or whether we're going to go over yet another cliff, and what this means for Obama and the future and all of that. So let me start, gentlemen, first on the question of how we got here. Just all those days leading up before and after Christmas when everyone said we're going over and Boehner had his plan B, which failed miserably. What were your thoughts about just the whole process leading up to the cliff? Let's start with you, Terry.
I wouldn't even call it a process. That's the first major problem. It didn't have any process. You know, I think it's sort of epitomized towards the very end, and I don't know if he stuck to it, but a few days ago, Boehner announced that for the future here, he's not going to negotiate. Now, I mean, you know, that is so absurd and so irresponsible as a congressman, or even as a businessman, or even as a citizen, just to simply say you're not going to negotiate. And that's basically what happened with the right wing of the Republican Party. The only good news with all of this was when they refused to do the help for all the people hurt by the storm Sandy.
Right.
And that sort of put things really in perspective as to what the Republican Party is and what their process is, which is simply to deny social responsibility on their part.
Garland, what was your thought about the circus? Well, maybe I should say that's a better word than the process. The circus that went up to right to the last minute.
Hey, I think there was a circus, and I think the circus taught us some things. And we should have, that many of us probably should have learned before that, and that is that the entity that we are referring to as a party, as a Republican Party, is a group of warring factions now. They are totally and completely dysfunctional. I think John Boehner said that he's not going to negotiate because he's in no position to negotiate. How can John Boehner negotiate a deal, as he found out last summer with the sequestration, as he found out again here with the fiscal cliff, that when he gets a deal and walks back to the warring factions that we call a party, he can't deliver anyway. They don't listen to it. So what we found out is our government is dysfunctional because a particular party within the Democrats, whether we like the deals or not, they can always beat their guys up and guys and girls up, and they can get the votes they need to pass something to keep the government at least functional. The Republican Party is dysfunctional, which now makes our Congress, and I put squarely the blame on the Republican Party, our Congress is the greatest threat to the United States economy, if not the world economy, in existence today.
I think you're right, Garland. One thing I found really interesting is when I was working in Congress, which is already 10 years ago now, we had trouble getting all the Democrats to stick together. There were conservative Democrats in those days. Boy, that seems like ancient history. And there was this whole blue dog contingent, and we had a hard time getting Democrats to stick together, but the Republicans would vote like lockstep. And as much as I think we're a little jealous, frankly, of them. Now we see the opposite. It's very strange. The Democrats have a very disciplined party. Who would have thought our party could actually show some discipline? Well, as you point out, Garland, that the Republican Party is in all directions. And then I thought it was interesting, the personalities. Republicans so hate Obama, and Boehner is so incompetent, that they went to two, I guess, call them lesser personalities. But the people who struck the deal, let's face it, were Vice President Biden and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. I mean, you know, it wasn't the President of the United States. It was the Vice President. It wasn't the leader of the Senate, Harry Reid. It wasn't the leader of the House, Speaker Boehner. It was Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate. And so you had two people who were not, I think, out looking to politically posture, but actually looking to make a deal. And I got to tell you, Joe Biden, I've always liked the man, but I think he did really good. I don't know, maybe you think he gave too much away, Terry.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Joe Biden, and I don't want to put the blame on him. The blame stands on the Republican Party, although the Democratic Party is guilty in some ways. You know, as one economist put it, as one of the economists put it regarding the solution to the cliff, he just said, George Bush wins, which is a really interesting comment. And you know, there's things tucked in there that are frightening, and the big one that's not tucked in that we know about is the repeal of the payroll tax, which is going to cost everybody. You know, anybody making about $50,000 is going to have to pay an extra $1,000 in taxes.
If you're living on $50,000,
you can barely get by.
Before you get to the other goodies, let's talk about the payroll tax, because that was very interesting, because Obama put that on the table to begin with. He did not want it to go up. He said, you know, we're still in a recession. It's still good to go to be low. And the irony is that the whole question, whether it was Obama's original plan, don't raise taxes on anyone below $250,000, or even the Boehner plan B, don't raise taxes on anyone under $1 million, if they'd simply left the payroll tax alone, they could have kept with these highfalutin pledges. But Obama tried, he didn't get it, and he gave it up pretty quickly. And so actually, middle-class taxes will go up, but nothing to do with the income tax. Garland, were you surprised by that outcome, giving up the payroll tax?
No, two things about that. Number one, I think it shows this. You know, as much as the Republican Party says they're against this or that, they're not really against anything that they say they're against. You know, they're against raising taxes. Well, ultimately, the people who took it on the chin, they did raise taxes on the working class more so than anybody else. So they're not really against taxes. And also that what this shows is this. Is it a good deal? Yes. Is it a bad deal? Yes. I mean, here's what I mean. What the payroll tax shows is this, that it's a bad deal because the working class gets hit. It's a good deal in context. In the context of you're dealing with psychos, madmen, and ideologues, it's the best deal you could get with these crazy people. But the best deal that you could possibly get with these rigid nutcase ideologues is always going to be a bad deal for the working class and a good deal for the rich.
Except, you know, Terry, the nut jobs, Grover Norquist actually endorsed raising the payroll tax, which strikes me as it's just fascinating. Norquist is supposed to be the Mr. Anti-Tax guy of all kinds, but apparently when you raise taxes on working people, Norquist was fine with it.
Which shows something. That shows what he's really about. He's not against, and the Republican Party is not against raising the taxes at all. They're only in favor of protecting the top 1% and the corporate class.
One of the things that really needs to happen, be it by Boehner, be it by us, you know, we've got to start naming the Republicans, the right-wing Republicans, because the right-wing Republicans are still not in the majority of the Republican congressmen. They are in the minority, and we've got to really be putting the pressure on them publicly, saying, hey, these are the clowns that are preventing this country from making any kind of significant economic progress, and Boehner's got to do the same thing.
Terry, I don't mind calling them out, but I'm not so sure they're in the minority. I mean, if you look at the deal on the fiscal cliff, 2/3 of Republicans voted against it. Boehner voted for it because he sort of understood that the entire country would blame the Republican Party if we went over the cliff. But remember, it passed with Democratic votes. 90% plus of Democrats voted for it. 2/3 of Republicans voted against it. So, Terry, if we're going to call them out, we need to call out, I think, 2/3 of Republicans.
Keep this in mind regarding that vote, Mark, and that is,
Let Terry finish, then you go next.
You know, yeah, I mean, I understand your point, but a large percentage of those Republicans that voted for it did so only because, frankly, they're afraid. And they're afraid because they're going to be challenged by the Tea Partiers. They're going to be challenged about, you know, by these Republican nut jobs. And, you know, so the actual majority of really crazy, non-negotiating, non-thinking, non-caring Republicans is not the majority of the Republican Congress. It may even be the majority of the Republican Party. I doubt it. But, you know, it's maybe 50% of those 200-some Republicans that voted against it are really that conservative. They're just pressuring the other guys, and the other guys are running in fear because nobody does call out these bums.
I agree, and Terry stated what I was going to say, only much more clearly. That is
that
I got to give you credit there, Terry. And that is that
It's clearly a new year then.
And that is that what we're really seeing here is there are a lot of Republicans who are saying, you know, privately, look, you know, I know we need to do this, but if I go home, I'm a dead man here. If I go home, they're gonna give me a primary and I'm gonna lose. So what we're really seeing is that the Republican Party, regardless of how the individual members feel, is now guided. The rudder is being steered by far right wing nutcase ideologues, and they are seizing more power all the time, and they're running this ship aground. And you know what? We're kind of all on the same boat.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen to this country, but we're in a world of trouble.
But see, I want to be clear. I don't think this is irrational behavior. Remember that all the Republican districts in the House are gerrymandered, and they're gerrymandered
right.
very clearly to have a Republican majority. And only about 15 Republican House incumbents had any threat in the last election, and maybe 10-15% of their caucus actually has a threat of losing re-election. The other 85-90% don't. So their biggest threats are from the right. They're not from the Democrats. It's not irrational that they're looking more to their right than to the center of the country due to the gerrymandered district lines. People think, well, Republicans are crazy. Why aren't they doing what most of the Americans think? And people forget they don't represent most of the Americans. We should never stop telling people. We should never stop reminding people that more Americans voted for a Democratic member of Congress than a Republican member of Congress in 2012, and only because of fancy drawing of lines are they in power at all.
Yeah, you know, one of the people we got to call out too. I mean, you know, I'm beginning to believe almost that, you know, Rush Limbaugh is actually running the country.
He has been for several years, Terry. Where you been?
I'm sorry?
He's been running it for several years. Where have you been?
Yeah, well, I know. And I mean, but, you know, we need to call him out, too. And I think maybe even, you know, I know it's tough on a politician to do this and tough for a president to do this, but there is such irresponsibility by Rush Limbaugh, whether it be the gun issue, whether it be economic issues, immigration issues. He is still, you know, I got a tremendous audience, you know, 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, and he is just a dogmatic ideologue, which I guess is redundant, but he is really corrupting the whole political process of this.
Terry, he says he's just an entertainer. He's just a comedian. He's just joking around. That's what he says.
Well, you know, and let me ask you this. It goes back to Nietzsche, you know, the Nietzsche, where some people said that he, you know, started the whole crazy right-wing Nazi stuff in Germany, and other people said he was a representation of a culture that was moving in that direction anyway. So the question with Rush Limbaugh is this. Is Rush Limbaugh the culprit here? Is he the guy who's making this happen? Or does he simply represent the fact that there are a lot of people who feel this way, whether he says it or not? Because you've got the Mark Levins, you've got the, you know, the Sean Hannitys, you've got other people saying the same things, the Bachmans and the other, you know, dogmatic ideologues here. So I don't know if Rush Limbaugh is the guy who creates this phenomenon, or maybe more that he just represents the fact that these people are here, they have been here, and they're seizing power of their party, which gives him more power.
Good old Rush has been on the air for, what, 30 years now?
1987,
yeah.
25
you know,
years.
He started talk radio as we know talk radio today.
That's true.
And his listenership has stayed about the same. He's still on over 500 stations, you know, and it's
about
been
30 million
constant
people, 10%
barrage
of the country.
Going back to Ross Perot, you know, with Rush Limbaugh hollering in that regard.
But let me say this.
I think
they're on the decline. I think this fiscal cliff deal has really harmed the Republican brand and even more so the Tea Party brand. Every single person you mentioned, Garland, whether it's Michelle Bachmann, people in power, she almost lost her election, by the way.
Yes.
Her election to Congress. She got very, very close in a conservative Minnesota district to losing her election. I think the entire Tea Party will be seen by historians as a flash in the pan. 2010 was their high water mark. 2012 2012 were on the decline. I think by 2014 they're dead. I really think that I don't care what Rush or Sean Hannity or Mark Levin or any of them say. I think they're seen as angry people who have no agenda other than to tear Obama down, to tear the nation down. Don't you think this whole fiasco will irreparably harm that brand?
I do, but I'll say this. Meanwhile, they have an inordinate amount of power within the Republican Party, who controls the House and controls the purse strings, and therefore within our government. So until they are out of, pushed aside, which could be, gerrymandering could be a lot longer than we'd like to believe, they have enough power to really, really screw things up, and they're doing it.
And you got to remember too that there are 10-1 conservative talk show hosts. Conservative over progressive or even liberal, which is astounding. I mean, I hate to admit that we're not broadcasting to the entire world and that everybody isn't listening, because certainly
we are on the internet, everyone. We are at WeActRadio.com or MarkLevineTalk.com. We are broadcasting to the entire world. Just want to be very clear on that. But go ahead, Terry.
Well, we cannot underestimate their power. We really can't. And, there's only two ways to defeat that kind of power without getting crazy, and one is to confront them directly, which may or may not work, and the other is, frankly, to point out what a joke they truly are. And yes, Rush Limbaugh is a master at entertainment, so, everybody else has got to start playing up, this guy's a clown, and he's a very good clown, and a very, very well-trained clown, and he has one song, and only one song, and that is the extreme right nonsense. And we've really got to attack these guys.
The clowns are going to take their revenge soon, or so they say. There are three more cliffs coming up, and they're all coming up around March 1st, pretty much all in the month of March. So there's three cliffs to come. We're not done here yet. One cliff is, and then the most important cliff, is the debt ceiling. The Republicans are threatening to default on the national debt, which it always bears repeating. That's what I mean to say. It always bears repeating that the United States has never once defaulted on its debt, even the Revolutionary War, Civil War, Depression, World War II, you name it. We have paid our debts. In the Civil War, they had to print money. It was the first time ever. They didn't use gold and silver, but the Union paid their debts. And Republicans are threatening to not pay our debts, which would throw the United States and the world into a massive depression. That's the biggest cliff coming up. We're running out. Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, is already playing games, trying to finagle the accounts to give us two more months. That's the biggest thing. There are two other cliffs, though, that should be mentioned. One is the sequester, the idea that the government's going to cut spending 9%. All they did was put that off for 2 months. That's going to happen in March as well. It's the exact same thing that's going to happen this January 1st, but that's not resolved. And then the third issue is funding the government. Remember that issue? That used to be a big issue in the 90s? Well, that seems to be the least dangerous, simply shutting the entire government down. The whole big thing that they fought about in the 90s is now the least dangerous of the three cliffs we're going over. But this battle isn't done. It's not like January 1st resolved everything. We have another battle coming up in March. So I'm going to ask you both for predictions. What's going to happen? Let's start with the debt ceiling, because that's by far the most dangerous. President Obama has said he won't negotiate. You heard Boehner say he won't negotiate. If no one negotiates, and if President Obama doesn't pull out the Constitution and read the 14th Amendment, Section 4, one of my favorite, more obscure parts of the Constitution, the one that says that the validity of the public debt shall not be questioned, which to me is very strong language. Come on, folks, read this Constitution. And by the way, on that issue real quick, Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, because I've been pushing this issue now ever since 2011, for 2 years, Nancy Pelosi was finally asked about the 14th Amendment. She said, if I were president, I would cite it, but I'm not president. That's terrific. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, either she or Joe Biden, probably she is the second most powerful Democrat in the country. Well, no, Harry Reid, whatever. She's up there in the top five. For her to say that she would cite that Constitution, I think maybe that's starting to build pressure on Obama. That, to me, is his loophole. He needs to do it. So let's start with the debt ceiling. I don't know who wants to go first, but tell me what's going to happen in 2 months, your predictions.
It's going to be chaos, as always, and it'll come down to the last minute, but there's two things relating to all this that are so important, Mark and Garland, and that is the voters you know, as you said, Mark, the battle is not over. The voters, the liberals, the progressives, anybody that frankly cares about this country have to be get activated. They cannot sit back and watch this happen. They've got to get involved now because two terrible things can happen. One, they could get to the point where they, you know, don't renew the debt or raise the debt limit. I seriously doubt that'll happen. They'll go down to the wire again. They'll go down to the last minute, and they'll get it by one vote, and it'll pass, and the debt will not be sacrificed in that way. But in these last-minute deals, they sneak through so much crap that is damaging to the American public. And I want to give you one example of this that happens. This has happened on with the solution to the fiscal cliff, and that is the active financing exception. And I just want to give you this example because this is why we've got to be involved as citizens. At the last minute, this is put in. You know, it's for the financial service industry. The financial service industry is like 20% of the GDP. I mean, it's a huge power in this country. And the active financing exception, you know, it allows companies with financing arms such as Ford and General Motors and, of course, the banks, Morgan Stanley, that they put their taxes abroad and the interest on their tax, or the interest rather on their income, they put that abroad. And by putting it abroad, they don't have to pay any tax to the United States. And this is a crime. This was actually repealed
That was already the law. I mean, I hate that law, but it already was the law that...
Yeah,
that,
but, you know...
I mean, Mitt Romney, of course, put a bunch of stuff in Bermuda and Cayman Islands and so forth. What was the goody in the deal that made this law worse? Explain that to us.
That gets complex. You know, it permits banks like Morgan... I'm quoting here. Banks like Morgan to avoid 35% U.S. corporate tax rate on interest income from money lent overseas.
So maybe it's the interest that goes up in the deal. It is complex. I don't know all the details, but the goodies that I read were goodies to auto racing industry. I want to know which member of Congress is out there saying we need to subsidize auto racing. NASCAR needs American subsidies because they're not going to make it on their own as a sport. Not enough people are going to go to car racing. We need subsidies for auto racing. But it wasn't just them. I mean, Democrats. Puerto Rico is a very democratic part of the you know, Commonwealth, United States, and their rum manufacturers got special benefits. And again, I think people will drink Puerto Rican rum without taxpayer subsidies, just like I think they'll continue going to NASCAR. And that was all stuck in, my guess is through Mitch McConnell. Garland, your thoughts.
Okay, a couple things. Number one, are you guys familiar with the platinum solution to the debt ceiling?
Platinum?
Yes. Okay, it's under 31 U.S. Code, Section 5112. In general, the Treasury Department is not allowed to just print money if it feels like it. It must defer to the Federal Reserve's control of the money supply. But there is an exception. Platinum coins may be struck with whatever specifications the Treasury Secretary sees fit, including denomination.
This law
was intended to allow the production of commemorative coins for collectors, but it can also be used to create large denomination coins that Treasury can deposit with the Fed to finance payment of the government bills in lieu of issuing debt. So the president can instruct the Treasury Secretary. Now, there's been extensive read up on it, guys. There's been extensive research. It's pretty much been confirmed. If you look up Congressman Stadler, and I think Harry Reid has also, they've sent letters to the White House. The Bloomberg News people researched it and said, yes, it's true. The president can say, issue a platinum coin for whatever amount we need to cover the debt ceiling and move forward, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
I'll tell you something. It's a cute solution. It's a loophole. Rather than actually defaulting on our debt, I would try anything.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you this. I'd much rather go the more direct route because that's sort of a cute solution. It's working through a loophole. To me, the direct route is the Constitution. I mean,
I'm just throwing that out there to make this position, Mark, and that is, number one, there are alternatives. Whether it's the constitutional solution, whether it's this solution, the White House has alternatives, number one.
I'm not sure that platinum one is valid, though, because it's extremely rare metal, It's already, you know, one of the precious metals. Most of it, I'm pretty sure, is in China. That has the biggest deposits of platinum at the moment, which would be real interesting.
No, but Terry, you misunderstand.
Amount
you
of money.
You misunderstand the solution. The solution is not to find the value of platinum worth $1 trillion. The solution is to take a platinum coin the size of a quarter that might cost you $1,000 and to print on it $1 trillion.
Yes.
And to say, face value, just remember, a penny or a quarter or whatever, the metal in a quarter is not worth 25 cents, right? They make money when they mint quarters. So it's only worth a cent, but they print on it 25 cents, and lo and behold, it's worth 25 cents. The idea of what Garland is saying is not find a platinum to get $1 trillion, but simply get a platinum to make a nice, pretty coin, and then stamp on it $1 trillion.
That's basically it. The government would simply, basically say, here's a, whatever, if it was a dollar, a platinum coin, whatever, and put, like Mark said, put a lot of zeros on it, boom, and say that covers the debt. But all I'm saying is, as Mark said, I prefer the constitutional solution. If they don't feel that that's valid, there are options. But what I was going to throw out when we talked about all these upcoming cliffs and swings and things like that, what does it really show? It shows that our government is broken and cannot function and cannot govern. It demonstrates this. Now, if you notice something, in the past, the government, we'd say, well, we've got to, pay the federal employees. Oh, we've got to buy a new, fix a park or something. Whatever, we had to buy a park bench for Yosemite National Park, whatever it is. Now, any decision, number one, that the government is going to make, the House Republicans are going to say, give us $1 trillion in spending cuts and we're not going to pay for a park bench in Yosemite National Park. Every single thing that happens now, A, is a crisis, because the Republican Party's motto is now, if you can't fix the problem, make it worse. Everything is a cliff. Everything is a ceiling. Everything is a disaster. No longer do we have a government that can do its job. We have a government now that does nothing but manufacture crisis and can't even fix the crises that it manufactures. And I'm not going to say the government in a bad sense. It's not the Democratic Party. It's a dysfunctional, right-wing, rigid Republican not even party, group of warring factions. They can't agree amongst themselves, so certainly they can't work well enough to run our government with a party that they adversarial party that they disagree with anyway. We're screwed, guys.
And unfortunately, doesn't this get back to the root cause, which is unfortunately campaign financing and lobbying, and they are tied, they are wedded, they are married, and every single exception that has been put in any law, all of these deals that we're talking about, the things done behind people's backs, et cetera, is because of lobbying pressure, extraordinary lobbying pressure, primarily, of course, by the biggest industries and the banks, but even NASCAR, and everybody is forced to cave to that pressure because that reflects directly on what kind of campaign money they're going to be able to raise. It's a vicious cycle. How do we break that?
Let me throw something in here real quick to that, very brief, and that is, I think that's there's a unique dynamic that's starting, and that is I was talking to some Republicans the other day, and they were saying basically the big Wall Street banks and everybody is going to come to the Republican Party and say, you got to raise the debt ceiling. We don't want to hear this crap. We're going to lose everything if you do this. The markets will crash. We're quickly coming to a point where the two kind of what are becoming adversarial entities within the Republican Party, big Wall Street, who wants to live well, but they don't want to threaten the cash cow that is our economy, is running head up against the right-wing ideologue Tea Party members who are politically ignorant and who will they're suicide bombers. They'll blow themselves and us up by destroying our economy. So we're coming to a point, and that's what's going to be interesting to see, where this big money is going to have to clash with these Tea Party people and with the Republican Party and say, look, you guys are going to destroy this economy. We want to live wealthy, but we can't live wealthy if you destroy the economy.
Gentlemen, we've talked a lot about the Republican Party, which I find fascinating because, of course, we have a president of the United States that's about to be re-inaugurated in 2 weeks. He was elected by a substantial majority of the American people. The Senate, which everyone predicted was going to turn and flip over to the Republicans, actually gained two more Democratic senators and more liberal, progressive senators. Even we have, people, moderate Democrats like Joe Lieberman leaving and having good, strong progressives taking his place. So it's fascinating to me that for the Democrats who are, after all, they won all three branches of government except for the gerrymandering. That's the only reason they lost the House. And we're all talking about the Republican Party. So we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to focus on the Democratic Party, President Obama, his second term. What can he accomplish with or without the Republican Party? This is the Raucous Caucus. This is We Act Radio, 1480 AM. And we'll be right back. I don't think we're taking calls today, but we will be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts out there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. And my interest as a journalist is report the facts, here's what's going on, here's what the facts say, here's what history says, here are the lessons we know we have learned, and let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfalls, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell, you let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. Now, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong, but we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News, on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine here with Garland Nixon and Terry DeCastro. We are on every Sunday at 12 noon. You can catch our unique brand of commentary and comedy, I guess I don't want to call it. We try to deal with the tough issues of the day, but do so in a lighthearted fashion because, let's face it, we got enough trouble in this country for everyone to be gloomy all the time. So, gentlemen, I pose a question. We talked the whole first half hour about the Republican Party, and I find that fascinating. Even if they're dysfunctional, even if they're falling apart, still, we're talking about them, and I think that tells you something about where the agenda of this country is controlled by. Now, we just won an election. The Democrats won in 2012. They didn't just reelect President Obama. They won seats in the Senate and the House. Let's talk about the Democrats for a change. What can the Democratic Party do? What can President Obama do with or without the Republican Party on fiscal issues and on other things, too? I know President Obama just put forward an agenda, finally, for sensible gun regulation after the Newtown massacres, and we got to talk about whether he can do some of that with or without the Republican Party. But let's right now focus on the Democrats. What can we do? What should we do? Who wants to go first?
I'll jump in there. I know that may surprise you, Garland, but I'll jump in.
Not at all.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, and this is an overused statement, but I do think this time around, because what's at stake is so big, President Obama's State of the Union address is really going to be essential. And the question is, in regarding to what he says in this address, is how do you counteract fear? That's what he has to figure out. I'd hate to be the speechwriter for this. I'd love the challenge, but I would hate to be the speechwriter, having written many speeches for people, you know, in this situation. Because you're right, Mark, that the majority of the people at this point do have some faith in the Democratic Party. But at the same time, they're scared, and they're being scared by economic issues, by the Rush Limbaughs of the world, by even the way, you know, even the way we talk about some of the issues. It makes it all sound sort of frightening. If you remember, Mark, last week or a couple weeks ago, we talked about it being a physical slope as opposed to a physical cliff.
Right.
Defused it or tried to defuse it. Somehow or other, President Obama has to be very strong. Perhaps a little bit light. He's got to study Roosevelt, I guess, to figure out how do we get the majority of the people in power to make change. That's the challenge. And to do that, they've got to counteract the fear that the Republicans keep on creating for the most part, although media does it in general. It's a big challenge, and I suspect the State of the Union address is going to be quite a circus. And I hope that President Obama is prepared to deal with that circus. You know, we had a little bit of it when the guy screamed out, liar. You know, I suspect you're going to see more of that kind of thing happening. And the reason why this is so very important, and I'll make this very brief, the way you destroy a society, and it's been done in every society across the world, is just through the use of fear. And if the Republicans can keep on creating enough fear about fear of our government is what it really comes down to from their point of view. They want everybody to be afraid of our government. That is how you destroy a society, and we have to counteract that.
Let me just say this, and I'll throw it to you, Gar, in a second, but specifically on the State of the Union address. Of course, the State of the Union address is given every year, but the inaugural address is given only, you know, once or twice, except for Franklin Roosevelt, by any president. And when people start citing presidents, whether it's Roosevelt or Lincoln, you know, malice toward none, I could actually cite inaugural addresses. I would argue, I'm not saying the State of the Union is not important, Terry, I think it is, but that tends to be a laundry list. The nice thing about the inaugural address is it can rise above a laundry list of things to do. And he needs his laundry list. We need to talk about immigration and gun control and climate change and fiscal cliff issues. And, I mean, there's a lot of things to discuss, and unemployment. But my hope is the inaugural address is actually even more important than the State of the Union address. It's coming just in 2 weeks, by the way. He's going to be inaugurated on January 20th per the Constitution. But because that's a Sunday, the official inauguration will take place on Monday, January 21st. That's, I think, his opportunity, a real opportunity to speak to the entire nation. More people will watch the inaugural address than the State of the Union address. I plan to be out there in the cold, huddled with the masses, watching it in person. But I really think that this is his chance to get above some of the nitty-gritty details of policy, which I think weigh any president down, and talk about goals for this country, goals of equal opportunity for all, goals of giving the working class a chance to succeed, and really sort of broader goals than the nitty-gritty, and hopefully will inspire Americans to call their members of Congress to push them to do the right thing.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mark, and I appreciate that, and you're throwing that in. But I believe the inaugural address, you say, I agree, it is, you know, probably in some ways more important, but he's got to carry it over to the State of the Union address. He doesn't need to do the laundry list. Nobody believes the laundry list anyway. Let him do that inspirational speech in both occasions that gets people united to some degree. And I mean by united just that 65% of the voters.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say something that sounds a little more radical. I think he has to go head on to the Republican Party and snap it in half like a twig. And I'll tell you what I mean. Right now, we're seeing a party that is in complete disarray, and there are two very, very clear entities that are at odds within the party, and that is the wealthy corporate power and the rigid ideologues. And the reality is this, as much as I hate to admit it, you can bargain with the wealthy corporate power more than you can bargain with the ideologues, because the wealthy corporate power wants to survive.
They just want to make money. They don't care about.
So here's what I think the president needs to do. When it comes to this debt ceiling and it comes to some of these upcoming things, particularly the debt ceiling, I think he needs to say, I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to do anything. And guess what, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, if you guys are going to crush this economy and you're going to throw us into a depression, I'm going to wait and see if you're going to do it or not. Number one, that's number one. Number two,
Garland, you ever play poker? Garland, you ever play poker?
No, let me go to the other side.
That's a huge bluff, because would Obama really let us go over the cliff?
You haven't heard part two.
All right.
Part two, you go to Wall Street, you go to the big banks, and you go to the powers that be, and you say, guys, yeah, I'm not playing. I can't do it. Only they can do it. Remember something. I'm not the one bluffing or not bluffing here. I don't have the ability to stop us from going over the fiscal cliff. They do. If you guys want to save your necks, I'm not really bluffing, because I'm the president. Guys, you Wall Street guys, you hedge fund owners, corporate CEOs, you're the one that they're bluffing on. They're holding your feet to the fire, because if we don't raise the debt ceiling, guess what? The stock market's going to crash. You're going to lose trillions. The economy goes down. Your guys are going to lose, not me. So you need to talk to your guys and set them straight. Now, what do you do now? You've got the superpower that gives money to the Republicans, going to the Republican leadership saying, guys, you're going to kill our cash cow, and we're not going to have that. Set them against each other, and you get out of the way, and you let that happen. You know, I've talked to Republicans recently, some fairly powerful Republicans, who said, and people who were in the Bush administration, who have said, oh, no, of course we can't let it go. We can't let that go. Of course we've got to raise the debt ceiling. That's ridiculous. We know that. You guys know that. They know they have to do it. I say you force their hand once and for all. If you don't break their back for the next 4 years, you're going to go through this, and sooner or later you're going to lose some real ugly battles. That's my opinion. And number two, as I was saying, it breaks the back of the Republicans. You set them against each other and make them decide once and for all who they're wedded to, the super rich or the rigid ideologues, the ignorant, rigid ideologues.
This may be the scariest game of chicken America's ever played. Now, of course, we all know what chicken is. For those of you who don't know, that's when two, usually some 17-year-old teenage boys, usually, but they both drive a car, and one drives one car and one drives the other car, and they drive towards each other from some distance. And the game of chicken is both sides say they're not going to swerve, they're not going to swerve. If you swerve, then you're chicken, you lose. If you don't swerve, the cars hit each other, and both of you die a horrendous quick death. So this is the ultimate game of chicken. And I got to tell you, I've been talking with Democrats, Garland, and they're afraid that Obama's going to swerve, that they don't think he can hold. I mean, he said he's not going to negotiate. They don't think he can hold the car. And let's face it, if we do not pay our debts, it is the ultimate horror, the ultimate game of chicken. I hope he doesn't. I hope we win this game. But it's very scary, because we do have very strong personalities on both sides of this thing.
I'll make one last comment, and that is this. That's the secret. It's a bad metaphor. It's not a game of chicken. It isn't. The Republicans know they have to raise it. Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, all the Fox News people, all the Republicans in power, the fraud is that they're saying we won't raise it. They know they have to raise it. It is not a game of chicken. In fact, Barack Obama could say to them, well, you know what, I'm not going to sign it unless you guys, what concessions are you going to give me or I won't sign it? They know it's not a game of chicken.
I'm not sure you're right there, Garland, and I hardly ever disagree with you, but, you know, because the ideologues do have a lot of power at this point, and I'm not sure that they're going to surrender that power. I would love to see the twig broken, as you put it, but if you've ever played a game of chicken, and I have not played it with cars, but I've been in other situations, the nut job wins.
I got to run. I just want to thank you guys and say I'll see you next week, but I have to run.
Okay.
Thank you, God, for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Terry. What was your point about the nut jobs?
The nut jobs always win the game of chicken.
Yeah.
Or if you have the collision.
Right, the person who's crazy enough to risk death and not swerve.
Exactly. And, you know, the problem is with this, these dialogues, I still think, and historically, if you look back, I don't think when you look at a Lincoln, when you look at a Roosevelt, yes, you can be really strong in your speeches and in your leadership and really bold. But if you don't, if you aren't inspiring somehow or other, if you aren't appealing to something on a whole higher level, more higher moral level, a social level, etc., you're not going to defeat the fear mongers. That's what has to be done. And any time in history you look back, either, you know, if you go into the ugly, let's do battle and I'm not going to play and all of that stuff, you're succumbing to their game. And
yeah.
You lose.
Well, I mean, and that's the fear. And I got to tell you, Democrats are already, they're already afraid that Obama's not going to stick to it, that he's not going to be able to keep it up. Because, I mean, Garland's right in the sense that the Wall Street Republicans, the conservatives, know that they cannot default the national debt. Boehner and McConnell know that. That's true. But Obama also knows that, and Biden knows that, and Reid and Pelosi also know that, and Treasury Secretary Geithner also knows that. So that's the thing about the game of chicken. Nobody wants to die. I mean, nobody really wants to crash the cars. But if they're both standing firm, and I got to tell you, there are a lot of Republicans that said, all right, Boehner, we'll allow you to let the Democrats vote on this fiscal cliff. We'll allow this because we know in this next round we didn't get any spending cuts. We're going to get them. We're only going to get them by using the debt ceiling. So they're raring to go. And that's why I really, really like the constitutional option. I'll just mention it one more time because everyone should be aware of it. Section 4 of the 14th Amendment says, and it's an amazing section. It's never been used in American history. It was done after the Civil War because the Union wanted to make sure that their debts were paid, the Confederate debts were not paid. And so they said the validity of the public debt authorized by law shall not be questioned. Shall not be questioned. You can't even question it. I mean, it's very, very strong language. Don't pay for the Confederate debts, but any debts incurred by the United States of America authorized by law shall not be questioned. Now, these debts are authorized by law. As President Obama has made very clear, defaulting the national debt is not to buy new stuff. It's to pay for the old stuff, the stuff that Congress already authorized. I don't know why. I firmly disagree with the president's lawyers on this. I don't know why they have said they're not going to use it. There may be political reasons, but for legal reasons, Obama has to use it. And by using it, it will fortify his side. It's saying, I'm not playing chicken because no one's going to die. We're not going to swerve. I'm going to pay these debts. Sure, I'd rather we reach a deal. That would be nice. But if push comes to shove, I will cite the Constitution, Article 4, you know, the 14th Amendment, Section 4, before we default on the national debt, and then he's out of it. And the only way they could get him to default would be to sue him and have the United States Supreme Court order the president to default on the national debt, and I guarantee you Chief Justice Roberts is not going to do that. I really think it's an out for the president, and we've convinced Nancy Pelosi. We've now got to convince the president of the United States.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mark, and I think that's the wise solution, and maybe as voters and everything else, we should really be pushing that. Because one, not only would it, you know, solve the problem, but two, it would circumvent the circus.
Right.
Get away from the crisis that these guys are trying to create. Randall Ray, the economist I have the greatest respect for, of the Minsky School, out of Kansas City, the Minsky School of Economics, pointed out to me in one of the interviews I was doing with him that one of the things Wall Street really wants out of all of this is they want your retirement. They really want to take over the whole retirement game. I believe that Wall Street would let it crash. I think the financial industry would let the whole thing crash because I think they would find ways to then use the panic, use the excitement after the crash to make all kinds of horrible changes that would really rob the average person of whatever benefits and whatever security they have so that the banks can get even more control. And the way to defeat that, I think you're exactly right, is let them play the game, let them go through the game, but make it clear even a little bit before you get to that chicken point. Hey, you guys are going to play chicken, fine, you go ahead and play chicken. Don't forget, the 14th Amendment requires that I, as president, do not let the debt continue without being
supported. And the other two parts, frankly, are far less dangerous. I mean, it doesn't make the president dictator, because they could still shut the government down. They can still do the sequester or not do the sequester. They could change government spending. No one's saying the president's taking control and preventing Congress from acting. Congress can pass whatever laws it wants. But what the 14th Amendment says is, once the Congress decides to spend the money, the validity of the public debt shall not be questioned. And, you know, call me a textualist, but I'm someone who firmly believes that the text of the Constitution has value. And frankly, if you simply show people what it says, don't just say, I'm going to use the constitutional option and then look like to call Obama a dictator and things like that. Read the text of the Constitution. I don't know why that text is questioned at all. Okay, let me switch to, go ahead, real quick.
Just wouldn't it be great, Mark, if during the inaugural address and the State of the Union address, you know, President Obama just took out a copy of the Constitution and just
read
that part. Didn't have to say anything else. Just read.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That would be a beautiful, beautiful thing. You have to get me to write that speech for the president.
We should be a speechwriter.
We do that. Hey, are you going to be at the inaugural? Because I'm going to be out there in the cold again. I was there 4 years ago.
I'm not sure.
Were you there 4 years ago, Terry?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know,
you're on the other coast now, so.
I'm sorry?
You're on the other coast now, so it's a lot harder to get there.
I'm on the other coast now, yes. And, you know, it's interesting, too, to be on the other coast. I should be, you know, sort of blunt about that, too, because the problems that we're seeing on a national level, they're no different throughout the rest of the country as they are on a national level. They're the same on the state level, and the same game is being played. And somehow that we've got to do all of the above, or we got to require our politicians to do all that we've talked about, from what Garland said, you know, to really stand up to them, to what we've been talking about, go around them, you know, and three, inspire. We've got to raise the debate to a higher level, because the level it's reduced to now is, in fact, destructive.
Terry, you had mentioned all of the goodies that went in. I didn't know if there were any others you wanted to mention, but specifically how it is that this happened, because none of these goodies were discussed in the grand bargain between Obama and Boehner, none of these tax benefits. My guess is Mitch McConnell stuck them in, though some of these things, you know, it's hard to find authorship. But in general, when Congress is doing everything at the last minute and everyone has an hour to read the bill, that's when the lobbyists work best, because they know it's a must-pass bill. They can throw whatever they want in there. The congressmen can shrug their shoulders and say, well, I had to pass this bill, or we're going to lift this request. And so the rum distilleries and the NASCAR race drivers, and or not the drivers, the owners, the ones that Mitt Romney knows.
Well, this is part of the reason. This is part of the reason we've got to raise the level of the conversation. We really honestly need to, and need to require them to do it in terms of just honesty and transparency. Let me give you one other example, the pass-through exemption, which is part of the package to prevent us to go over the cliff, supposedly, permits a U.S.-based company to set up a new corporation in a tax haven like the Cayman Islands and sell it a patent owned by the U.S. parent company.
Then, so it's the
royalties on overseas licensing of that patent would then route to the tax-sheltered firm instead of the U.S. parent company. Therefore, they can avoid paying any taxes again on that. And these kinds
that's substantial. When you think about the tech companies today, whether it's Google or Apple or Microsoft or Motorola, their patents are sometimes the most valuable part of the company. And if they could ship those offshore, that was a nice little thing stuck in. I hope we can find out these provisions, who stuck them in. I'm quite confident they came from Mitch McConnell, the Republican side of the aisle. Although if a Democrat came, did it, I'll be condemning them as much, I promise. But find that out and have a remove loopholes from bill. Right? Wouldn't that be great? You could have to remove loopholes from the Thistle Cliff bill. And that's how I would label it. First of all, we'd reduce the government deficit, because I know all these things cost money, all this corporate welfare. Remove corporate welfare bill. And some enterprising, if I were still in the House, I could do this. You'd simply go through, write up all the special benefits, all the things that were not discussed. Everyone discussed the income tax, the estate tax, things like that. But take out the goodies. Remove goodies from bill.
Yeah.
and then and have the president support that in the State of the Union speech.
Yes.
I got to tell you something. If it's like you shine a light on a cockroach and it scurries mm-hmm. away. I think if we shine a light on these things, like you've been doing, Terry, but have the president do it, have the Democrats do it. I don't think the Republicans are going to want to be there saying, yeah, we supported all this corporate welfare. Remember, their whole mantra, it may be false, but their whole mantra is we don't want government spending. We don't want welfare. So, okay, Republicans, why are you giving welfare to auto racing industry? That doesn't make any sense. They don't need it. So, again, by shining a spotlight on it, we can make this bill even better.
We've got to, you know, and again, this all gets down to the one power that we have left, and I do say left because I think we are in some peril. That is, the citizens have to be active. They have to be writing to the president right now, calling the president right now, checking on, you know, with the various not-for-profit associations that we know that have integrity and that have petitions, you know, to the president, signing those and getting the word out. We want a country that is open. We want legislation that is transparent. We don't want last-minute crisis. We want you, as President of the United States, to lead us, to inspire us, to identify some of the problems. Just point out in your State of the Union address. Wouldn't it be great if you just pointed out, you know, we have this pass-through thing that allows patents to be put outside the United States, you know, by a parent company here. And I don't think that works very well for the benefit of the American people, for the economy. You know, I'd just like to know who's in favor of that, you know, and even ask the Congress sitting right there.
If you're in favor of it, stand up. If you support it,
yes.
Ask the Congress, the State of the Union, all of you who support giving corporate welfare to auto racing, please stand up.
Yes.
Stand up right now. And see who stands up. Wouldn't that be great?
It
see
would
who stands
be wonderful.
Up. All of you who favor, you know, special benefits to Puerto Rican rum. That's probably our Puerto Rican representative. But okay. All right. Stand up. There's something for Alaskan salmon fisheries. I forget all the
yep.
details. But here's the thing about that bill. It would be extremely popular. That's the thing about it. Sometimes doing the right thing is not hard. It's actually easy politically. This is something that Democrats and Republicans can get behind. Republicans say they don't want wasteful spending. Okay, let's not give money to NASCAR owners. Stand up. Let's not do these pass-throughs for patents. You have to explain what it is. But stand up. That would be amazing because I think that's a bill that could pass through very, very quickly. I remember in the health care bill, they had to do all these little add-ons to get Ed Nelson's mm-hmm. vote, the 60th vote, the most conservative Democrat in Congress. They called it the Cornhusker kickback because it was special benefits for Nebraska. And then they got his vote, and then they repealed the Cornhusker kickback. He can do this, and it would be very, very popular. And I got to tell you something. I think his approval rating would soar because it wasn't just the Democrats. The Republicans would like this, too. It's a great idea. Of course, this station is called We Act Radio, and we could act to call in the president, write the president, to write members of Congress, encourage them to do this extremely popular thing that would not only help the country, but help us politically as well.
I do, too. I think it would be absolutely great. I guarantee you there would be an outrage from the media. There would be an outrage, you know, from the Republicans and probably some of the Democrats and all that. But I think with the people, it would really work. The same thing with the 14th Amendment, you know, is just using honesty is what it comes down to.
Right? Using the tools we already have. I mean, you know, these things, some of these problems are really intractable. It's very hard to figure out how you can make Medicare more solvent. Actually, I don't think it's that hard because what I would do is I would make everyone pay their Social Security taxes over $110,000 and that would cover it. But that's a tougher choice. That involves hard choices. This is not a hard choice. Repealing the corporate welfare, signing the 14th Amendment, these are things that we can encourage our government to do that help not only help the country, but help us politically as well. Terry, where can people find you if they want to?
They can find me at drofdemocracy@aol.com.
Dr of democracy@aol.com. And you can find me by going to my website, marklevinetalk.com, marklevinetalk.com. Please don't confuse me with that awful conservative radio host, Mark Levin.
They'll never confuse you with that. Trust me.
Well, you'd be amazed. You'd be amazed, Terry, by the people that confuse me. You can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Levin Talk. Every episode of the Raucous Caucus is recorded at We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and will be on my website at marklevinetalk.com. If you miss any aspect of the program, you can listen in and catch us there. And we are, of course, on every Sunday from noon noon to 1. Coming up is my own show, The Inside Scoop, where I give you the inside scoop and all things going on in Washington. I want to thank Garland, who had to leave us a bit early, and definitely thank you, Terry, as well, and look forward to talking with you next week.
We will do it, and again, Happy New Year to you and our listeners.
Happy New Year to everyone. All right, that is the Raucous Caucus. We'll be right back with The Inside Scoop right after this.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and I have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without big brothers, big sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil, and Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child, and that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Good afternoon, America. This is Mark Levine. That music is Javier Suarez. He is a Spanish artist that actually my intern, David Byfield, found for me, and I love it. It's non-copyrighted music. I can play as much as I want, but more importantly, it's good music. And it's kind of peppy, kind of lively. I like my opening music. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Got a lot to talk about today. Everything from some of those issues we talked about in the Raucous Caucus, the Supreme Court decision to finally take up the issue of same-sex marriage. The fiscal cliff is a perennial discussion. It's going to be until something is resolved. But I want to start out by talking about the Middle East, because I got to tell you something. I think these very, very important stories are getting lost in because of the fiscal cliff and, you know, Washington navel gazing, fighting with each other. Fighting in Washington, that's nothing new, right? I worked in Congress. I can tell you that fighting in Congress is old. But what's going on in the Middle East, that is new. And so I'm going to talk about Egypt and Syria and Israel and Gaza and all that stuff. But first, I want to make an announcement, one I'm very, very proud to announce right here on We Act Radio. I'll be announcing it, and you'll be hearing throughout really the next couple weeks. On Tuesday, December 18th, that's a week from Tuesday, at 7 o'clock p.m. right here in We Act Radio Studios, 1919 Martin Luther King Avenue, Junior Avenue, Southeast Washington, D.C., the great Congressman Barney Frank, my former boss, will be here along with the great Congressman John Conyers, two leading lions of the House. I can't think of two Democrats that are more essential and more important to passing progressive legislation than Congressman Barney Frank and Congressman John Conyers. Between them, they have been in Congress more than 70 years. So, Congressman Barney Frank, as you probably know, is retiring, and this will be his swan song. This may be the last speech he gives as a sitting congressman. You're not going to want to miss this. It's a fundraiser for the Inside Scoop and for We Act Radio, we're going to have more details on my website at marklevinetalk.com, on my fan page, the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook. None of it's posted there yet. I'm announcing it here first, then we're going to post it and hopefully get a big crowd here. You're going to want to hear the final words of Congressman Barney Frank. He is someone who has fought all the leading battles. Obviously, he's the first member of Congress to openly come out as gay. When he did it, it was an extremely brave and honorable thing to do. Now there's 7 or 8 members of Congress who are gay or lesbian or bisexual. But when Congressman Barney Frank did it, it was unheard of. And he actually sacrificed. He famously says that Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill told him, Barney, he was disappointed that Barney came out because he said, you could have been our first Jewish Speaker of the House. And maybe Barney Frank could have been Speaker of the House, but he decided that he was going to be honest and true to himself and to all the Americans who are gay or lesbian or bisexual and come out. But Barney Frank is not just known for that. That would be enough. That would be enough. But Barney Frank, of course, is the author of the Dodd-Frank legislation. It is the legislation to finally cut down on the power of big banks, financial service companies that are too big to fail, to protect our economy from some of the awfulness that happened in 2008. And a whole host of other things that you probably don't even know. He's actually one of the forerunners of immigration law. I mean, he's very strong in supporting immigration rights. He is strong in supporting rights for women, strong in supporting gun control. This is a guy who's been really on the forefront of progressive legislation, well, let's see, since 1978, so 34 years. He is retiring. You've probably seen there's a front-page article in the Washington Post. But we have him here at We Act Radio. And Barney, if you've never heard him speak before, particularly in person, I got to tell you something. Every year, the staff of Congress votes, and this is Democrats and Republicans get together, the staff votes on members of Congress superlatives. They have best looking members of Congress. Barney didn't win that one. They have, the most athletic or the wonkiest or the, most conservative, most liberal. Barney wins consistently in two categories every year. He's always voted the most brilliant man of Congress because the guy is smart. He's also voted the most funny man in Congress because he is hilarious. His wit is dangerous, and he uses it as a weapon. And if you've ever seen him argue against Republicans, it's funny. I used to watch him get up to speak in the House and watch the Republicans scurry out the door. They won't like this analogy, but I think of it like, rats when the ship starts sinking. I mean, they would run. They would run because none of them wanted to be up against Barney's caustic wit. And they would run away. I'd never forget, speaking of the Defense of Marriage Act, I remember when he would argue against Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia on the Defense of Marriage Act. And Bob Barr was talking about the sanctity of marriage and how allowing gay people to marry would destroy the sanctity of marriage, at which point Barney Frank got up and asked Bob Barr which of his marriages were sacred, his first, his second, his third, or his fourth. Which Bob Barr had his mouth drop open. He had nothing to respond to. And I just to me, that's just classic Barney Frank. I mean, he's done this hundreds and hundreds of times. It's going to be a real shame to lose him in Congress. He has a right to retire. He's just gotten married in Massachusetts, and he certainly has a right to have a very fine retirement. He's done so much good for so many people. But I got to tell you, Congress is going to be a little less without him. Without his voice, it'll be a little less funny. It'll be a little less brilliant. It'll be a little less progressive. It'll be a little less fun with Barney gone. So we're going to wish him well. And I want to encourage everyone listening to my voice to come on out to We Act Radio's. If you don't know where we are, by the way, we're just across the bridge from Capitol Hill. If you're coming from most of Washington, you just take 295, you know, the main road, that 395 becomes 295, and you get off at 8th Street, you follow the signs of Martin Luther King Avenue. It's just one bridge, and as soon as that bridge ends, you're in Anacostia, you're just across the bridge, there's plenty of parking, and come see us. If you live in Anacostia, this is an event happening in Anacostia. But I don't know, some people have these ideas of Anacostia. Let me tell you, this area is very good, very good area to be. And it's just across the bridge. It's easy to get to. It's easy to find, easy to park. So really, everyone, please come on down to hear Barney Frank Tuesday, 7 p.m. But that's not all, folks. It's not just Barney Frank, because Congressman John Conyers, who has been in the House longer than Barney Frank, he's been around since 1974, I believe. That's 38 years. So Barney's been here a mere 34 years. Congressman Conyers has been here 38 years. That's a long time. 76 years total. He is still going strong. He is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, the most powerful Democrat on that committee, which means if the Democrats take back the House in 2014, John Conyers will reclaim his chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee. And he's been a strong progressive voice for, well, more than 38 years. And he's still here. He's still going strong. He's going to appear with Barney. And again, you don't want to miss that. 7 o'clock on Tuesday, a week from Tuesday, right here at We Act Radio, 1919 Martin Luther King. There's going to be plenty to drink, plenty to eat, music. You can watch some clips of me on Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. You can watch me battle Bill O'Reilly. We're going to be playing those clips. On there, you can watch John Conyers talk about the founding of We Act Radio, why we need progressive media. All those clips will be playing in the rooms, but that you can watch that in the studio. You can hang out with your friends, have plenty to drink, plenty to eat, and support progressive media. Support Washington D.C.'s only commercial progressive radio station. And really, it's a last chance for you. It's your last chance to hear Congressman Barney Frank speak in Washington. He's going home to Massachusetts. We're going to lose this voice forever. Please come on down. Support We Act Radio. Support the Inside Scoop. Support Congressman Barney Frank and John Conyers Tuesday, December 18th. I can't wait. I'm nervous. I'm excited. And I think all of you listening to me should be too. And folks, if you want to call in, 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. When I come back, I'm going to get on to my main topic of the Inside Scoop today, and that is the Middle East. Because what happened in Egypt particularly is extraordinary and even a bit encouraging, and it's very hard to find encouragement in Egypt, but I find some, and we'll talk about that. And also what I find encouraging in Syria. Again, when 40,000 people are dead, it's very hard to find any encouragement. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I see hope for Syria and for Egypt and for Israel. So one cheer for each, not three cheers, because we have a ways to go in all three places. But let's talk about specifically what's going on there, what Morsi's decision means for Egypt, for the Middle East, for the United States, for President Obama. Where do we go from here? 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company.
Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds. If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I want to talk about Egypt, because Egypt is full of surprises, but let me give one cheer, maybe even two cheers for Egypt. They're not ready for three cheers yet, but my cheer is for the Egyptian people. It's not for Mohamed Morsi, the president. It's not for the judges. It's certainly not for the holdovers from the Mubarak regime. It's for those brave, brave, a lot of them are students, a lot of them are ordinary people, who came out in Tahrir Square in Cairo and said to their newly elected president, "We may have elected you, but you're not a dictator. That doesn't mean you're in complete control. We want a new Egypt." So let's back up. Let's remember the history. Let's remember where we got, why we got where we got here. Okay, so Egypt had been ruled by Hosni Mubarak ever since the assassination of Anwar Sadat in 1980. Hosni Mubarak was a dictator. He certainly ruled Egypt with an iron fist. Maybe not as bad an iron fist as Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. He certainly never gassed his people. But he certainly was a dictator. And he did not have freedom of speech. And people who opposed his regime were put in jail. And he was not the nicest guy in the world. Okay. Now, he was supported largely by the United States. We gave Egypt, ever since the Camp David Accords, 1979, we gave Egypt, we the American taxpayer, gave Egypt about $1 billion a year in aid. And in return, Mubarak was a mostly an ally of the United States, a fitful ally. He wasn't, you know, the strongest ally in the world, but he definitely wasn't, the guy before him in Sadat was Gamal Abdel Nasser. Now, that was a pro-Soviet dictator, just as much of a dictator as Sadat or Mubarak, but he leaned toward the Soviet Union. This time we had a dictator lean toward us. And so no great praise for Mubarak, but we bought his allegiance, and he largely stuck with us. Well, what happened, of course, 2 years ago with the Arab Spring, is the people amassed in Tahrir Square in Cairo, in massive numbers, hundreds of thousands, maybe probably millions, and demanded that Hosni Mubarak step down. And for a long time, President Obama wasn't sure what to do. I mean, Hosni Mubarak was a dictator, but he was a pro-American dictator. So which should it be? Should we be pro-democracy or pro the guy who's pro-American? And the worry was that the people opposing Hosni Mubarak were not just liberal students in Tahrir Square in Cairo, but also the Muslim Brotherhood. What's the Muslim Brotherhood? It's an underground organization of... It's kind of complex. The Muslim Brotherhood began in the 1920s. It's been around a very long time. It began in Egypt, and it's basically people who largely support an Islamic fundamentalist state. In other words, we might go from pro-American dictator to repressive anti-American fundamentalist dictator, which is exactly what happened to us in Iran. Remember what happened in Iran. We had the Shah of Iran, a dictator, tortured people, trained by the CIA, but extremely pro-American. He's overturned in 1979, and now we have a worse situation in Iran. As bad as the Shah was, and he was bad, as bad as he was, the Iranian leadership today is just as much of a dictatorship as under the Shah. They still torture people. They still mistreat people in prisons. They still have no free speech, and they have this fundamentalist element, right? They mistreat women. Women don't have the same rights that they used to have in Iran under the Shah, where they could vote and they could wear what they want. There's this Islamic fundamentalism. The Shah was not trying to invade other countries. Iran, today's Iran, says they want to destroy the state of Israel. They want to wipe it off the map. So you have a regime that's not good to its own people versus a regime that is not only not good to its own people, but is anti-American, anti-Israel, and is developing nuclear weapons. We'll talk, Iran's another issue, right? That's a big question of what to do next. Maybe if we have time, we'll talk about Iran as well. But Iran is what we were afraid Egypt would go into. And then we're left with a terrible choice. Pro-American dictator or anti-American dictator. Actually, this is an old problem. If you go back to the Cold War in Central America, we had that problem. We have pro-American dictators in El Salvador and Nicaragua that are mistreating their own people horribly, Guatemala. And many on the left were very concerned about that. I certainly was. But the argument was, well, if we don't have them, then the communists will be there. And they're dictators too. And they also will mistreat and torture their own people. And they'll be anti-American. And the argument is, in the choice between a pro-American dictator and an anti-American dictator, we'd rather have the pro-American dictator. Well, I argued then with Central America, and I argue today in the Middle East, that there can be a third way. You can actually have a pro-American liberal democracy. That you don't have to choose between pro-American dictator and anti-American dictator. You don't have to choose between a secular pro-American dictatorship and a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American dictatorship. But you can actually have a democracy. And you can have a democracy that I think at the end of the day, it'll be for its own interests, as any democracy should be. But I think most democracies at the end of the day will be, if not pro-American, and some will be, at least not anti-American. Because for all the mistakes of the United States of America, and we have many, I still think we're a leading light in the world for democracy. Look at a country like India. India has many, many problems. It's one of the poorest countries on earth. But it is a democracy. It's a steady democracy, has been a democracy since 1948. And India is, I think, pro-American. They're not, it's not like Europe. They're not strongly pro-American. They have their own interests, as well they should. But I think by mere fact that India is a democracy, we don't hear about terrorist training centers in India, right? We don't hear about Indians attacking America. We hear about them competing with us on the world market. And that's perfectly fair and just, and we'll compete with them back, and they have things they can do that we can't do, like very cheap labor. But the point is, India is an ally, or at the very least, not an enemy. We have our own interests, as we should, but we're never going to go to war with India. Pakistan next door is not the same. Pakistan is a new democracy, but it's not a steady democracy. It doesn't have steady democratic elements. It was a dictatorship for many, many, many years. I wish it well as a new democracy, but the democracy doesn't control all the fundamentalist elements. The ISI, which is their secret police, like their CIA, they still have powers that the president cannot control. Because Pakistan is not a full democracy, not yet. We hope for them, but not yet. That's why we see Al-Qaeda can take up residence in places in Pakistan. And Pakistan is still a threat to the United States. Not the Pakistani government, but people within Pakistan. So, going back to Egypt, the fear was with the Arab Spring, whether it be in Tunisia or Egypt or Bahrain or anywhere, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, well, Morocco's okay, Algeria, Libya, wherever the Arab Spring occurred, the fear was, and we'll get to Syria in a minute, that we were repressed, that as much as the people were uprising against horrible dictators, and as much as that we would obviously be on the side of people trying to overthrow tyrants, as we should always be, we could talk about whether to be there militarily or not, but at least our hearts should be on the side of anyone trying to overthrow a dictator. The fear was, particularly in Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood's been around since the 1920s, that if the people overthrew the pro-American dictator Hosni Mubarak, that they would then go the route of Iran. They would choose a fundamentalist Islamic dictatorship that would mistreat women, that would mistreat Christians, that would mistreat other minorities, and would end up being anti-American anyway, so the people wouldn't get, they go from dictator to dictator, and America would be worse off, and women and Christians would be worse off, and it'd be like Iran. The Shah was bad, but Khomeini and Khamenei are worse. So if you're president of the United States, how do you deal with that? President Obama was in a bind. How do you deal when the only two choices are terrible choices? Well, I think Obama came down to the right decision. He supported Mubarak a little later than I would have. I called for him to remove support from Mubarak earlier than he did. But at least he removed support from Mubarak before the people removed Mubarak. So at least he was on the right side of history, maybe only 2 weeks in time, but about 2 weeks before the people of Egypt removed Mubarak. And again, I wish Obama had withdrawn support earlier, but better late than never, right? So the people remove Mubarak, and they have an election. And the election comes down to two fundamentally awful choices. There are many, many people that voted. I was pulling for the liberals, the liberal Democrats. But when you've got a whole bunch of society, particularly based on the military, who support the old regime, who support Mubarak, and you've got the second largest group of society supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the underground movement that's been around for almost 100 years and was persecuted by Mubarak, it's very hard for that third group, the people I like, the students in Tahrir Square and the ordinary people who want liberal democracy, who don't want a fundamentalist dictatorship and don't want a military dictatorship, but actually want democracy, which has never existed in Egypt before, it's really hard for them to get organized. So they had an election. The people I like, the third people, the liberal Democrats, they got third. And it was a runoff. A runoff between the old regime, the Mubarak guy, his vice president, and the Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi. And people, liberal Democrats, were despondent. It was, you know, what kind of choice is that? How do you choose between the frying pan and the fire, as you might say? Well, I don't think it's a surprise that Morsi won the election. He won it by very close, by the way, 52%, which tells you that a lot of people were worried about the Muslim Brotherhood. They didn't want to go back to the Mubarak days, understandably, but they didn't want to go to this guy either. So you would think liberal Democrats would be out of it, right? You'd think we'd just switch from one dictator to another. Something wonderful happened in Egypt last week. And we're going to talk about it when I come back from break. 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is The Inside Scoop, and I will finish my story when we come back.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you know, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts out there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you, you know, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. My interest as a journalist is Report the facts. Here's what's going on. Here's what the facts say. Here's what history says. Here are the lessons we know we have learned. And let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfalls, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell, you let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. Now, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong, but we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News, on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. So I'm talking about what's going on in Egypt. And as always, whenever I have a discussion like this, I think it's real important to go through the history to understand why we are where we are. You can never understand the present without understanding the history behind it. As William F. Faulkner once famously said, I'm going to get this quote exactly right. I have the exact quote. I don't want to misstate it. It's something to say that never say the past is gone. The past is always with us. In fact, it's not even past. You know what? I'm gonna ask David. Find the exact quote. Let me get that exact Faulkner quote because I want to do the great writer justice. The point is, the past is always with us and always will be with us. So we've just talked about what happened in Egypt, and we just had the election, and Morsi won by a very close race, but the people that I want to support, the liberal Democrats, the people who believe in equal rights for all Egyptians, including women, including Christians, in a majority Islamic society, they're in a bind. They don't support the old regime. They don't support Hosni Mubarak, but they don't support the Muslim Brotherhood either, because the Muslim Brotherhood believes in really a fundamentalist dictatorship controlled by Muslims. And the answer is everyone should have equal rights. Yeah, Egypt's a majority Muslim society. It'll obviously have a Muslim tint to it, but the minorities, Christians, and also women should have rights as well. I mean, this is, after all, the 21st century. So they were kind of despondent. So what happens next? Well, what happens next is there's a war between Israel and Hamas. Hamas, which is the offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, a dictatorship. We have the quote here. So here it is. Faulkner was far more pithy, of course, than I am. He said, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." Thank you for that, David. That's exactly the quote I was looking for. The past is not dead. It's not even past. People are like, oh, the past is over. Yeah, no, it's not even past. In other words, the past is always with us. Every single thing we do in the present is affected by the past. The past is still here. And I thank you. Thank you, David, and thank you, William F. Faulkner, for that. The past is never dead. It's not even past. That was the point I meant to make. All right, so the past in Egypt, after Morsi wins, there was a lot of criticism from the right against Obama, as if Obama could have stemmed the tide of Egyptian democracy, as if Obama could have said to the people, the millions amassing in Tahrir Square, don't overthrow your dictators. The United States forbids it. What do you want us to do? Send U.S. bombers to go after the people of Egypt? Oh, how dare Obama leave? I think Obama should have deserted Mubarak sooner, frankly. But I'm glad he did when he did, because when the people overthrow their dictator, at least they won't see us as the enemy. Some may still, because we did support Mubarak for 40 years. But at least they'll recognize that our current president withdrew his support before the people knocked him out. But as I said, there's a lot on the right that said now Morsi, he's going to be anti-Israel, he's going to be anti-America, he's going to be he's going to set up a Taliban-like Islamic dictatorship like they did in Iran, and we're all going downhill, and as bad as Mubarak was, Morsi will be worse. That's what the right said, and I got to say, they had some legitimate fears. I fear that. I still fear that. I mean, after all, it happened in Iran. It's not like it can't happen anywhere. I still fear that. But I felt like Obama did the right thing in a difficult choice. He did say that Mubarak did not have his support anymore. So Morsi's in power. And an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, which is a Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood organization that has done exactly that thing, taken over Gaza, completely dictatorship, massive mistreatment of the Gazan people. He's gone against their political opposition is Fatah. That's the group that's in control of the West Bank. And they've rounded up people. They've tortured people. They've shot people. Quite famously, I just saw 2 weeks ago on CNN a gruesome picture where they had a guy, they tied ropes around this guy and they drew him by a truck through the streets, obviously killing him, because this person was someone that was opposed to the Hamas regime in Gaza. I mean, cruel, disgusting group. And of course, they have declared that they're going to continue their war until all of Israel is destroyed, until all the Jews leave Israel, until they have conquered every part of Israel from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And they're the ones who've been shooting rockets over into Israel. Of course, Hamas is very anxious that civilians die. So they've been sending rockets into Israeli cities. Thankfully, Israel has the Iron Dome. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on, but they have this wonderful missile defense system that's protected most of the people in the cities of Israel. And then Hamas also puts their rockets in Palestinian areas, in schools, in houses, because they know that when Israel will fight back and destroy those rocket launchers, they're likely to kill some civilians. And for Hamas, every dead civilian, whether Jewish or Arab, it's good. Because they don't just want the Israelis to die, they want their own people to die, because they know that will make the world angry at Israel. So they're a very gruesome organization. Israel fought back, and I think because of the Iron Dome, thankfully did not have to invade. But the real question was, what was Egypt going to do here? After all, Egypt is the only country that borders both Gaza and Israel, and Egypt has had a peace with Israel, a cold peace, but a peace nonetheless, since the Camp David Accords of 1979. They're the reason we started supporting Egypt in the first place, we the United States. Well, Morsi showed that he could put the interests of Egypt ahead of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, supposedly the people, Hamas, are supposedly his allies. They are Muslim Brotherhood. But they're fighting to destroy the state of Israel. They're fighting to destroy the people of Gaza. They're fighting for destruction. And Egypt is trying to rebuild. And so Morsi came up with a solution. His rhetoric may have been harsh, but behind the scenes, he worked with President Obama, worked with the Israelis, worked with Hamas to come up with the ceasefire and we'll see how Morsi goes. I'm afraid that he's still going to allow weapons, Iranian weapons, to come into Gaza to keep attacking Israel. But the point is, Morsi is not a crazy fundamentalist. He's not like the Iranians. He's not like Hamas. He's someone that we can deal with. Someone who apparently and appropriately in an elected position, cares more about the Egyptian people than he does about some great Islamic war. And that makes sense. War with Israel would not be good for Egypt. It wouldn't be good for Israel. It wouldn't be good for Egypt. Egypt has the greatest, some of the greatest poverty in the Arab world. Egypt, by the way, is the largest Arab country in the world. It's got, I don't remember how many, 60 million people, some huge number of people. And the vast majority are extremely poor. And Egypt needs development aid. It needs aid from the United States. It doesn't need a war. There's nothing a war could do that could help Egypt. And I think Morsi very wisely is keeping his peace with Israel. He's done his best to tone down Hamas. And that surprised a lot of people on the right, because they assumed that every Muslim Brotherhood leader is the same, every Islamic leader is the same, and they assumed that Morsi would turn out like Iran. And he didn't, at least so far. So he agrees with Obama, he gets the United States' blessing, he helps promote the ceasefire between Israel and Gaza, and then the very next day, he goes and he does something that the right warned us about. You see, I'm not claiming Morsi is some wonderful person. I recognize he's Muslim Brotherhood. I recognize he has his own interests. Just because he doesn't support war with Israel and just because he doesn't set Hamas loose doesn't mean he's a good man. It just means he recognized that Egypt's interests were not in another war. So the next day, right after he gets Obama's blessing for the ceasefire between Gaza and Israel, he says that the Egyptian Supreme Court, which, by the way, was appointed by Mubarak, and was challenging Morsi's constitution, the new constitution for Egypt that they're going to vote on December 15th, he said that he had the right, until the constitution was approved, to be supreme leader, to overrule anything the Supreme Court did, that basically everything would be in his control. And immediately the thought was, oh no, here we go again. Now we really have gone from the frying pan to the fire. We've gone from Mubarak to Morsi. We've gone from military pro-American dictatorship to, well, whether they're pro-American or not, another dictatorship in Egypt. And I think that's what Morsi wanted. I'm not denying it. I think he wanted to take over. He wanted to get rid of the last vestiges of Mubarak. He wanted to be in complete, fundamental control. And I had to say, well, you know, maybe the people on the right were right. You can't just, we couldn't trust Morsi. We couldn't trust Mubarak. There's just no way to win. And here comes the Egyptian people. They go back to Tahrir Square. I got goosebumps thinking about it. Having just fought a revolution, having just gotten rid of Mubarak, the Egyptian people come back to Cairo and say, Morsi, you can't do this either. Mubarak, you can't be a dictator. Morsi, you can't be a dictator. We don't care that you're Muslim Brotherhood. The point is that we are going to be a nation of laws, and you're not going to be a dictator any more than Mubarak was. And they come to Tahrir Square, and they come in the hundreds of thousands, and the military fights them back, and they keep coming, and they keep coming, and they say, Morsi, you can't do this. And lo and behold, Morsi backs down. That's what happened yesterday. Beautiful thing. Way to go, Egyptian people. It's so great when the people who are controlling world events are not powerful leaders with shady interests protecting their own pockets, dictators, or people who want to impose a caliphate all over the Middle East, but ordinary students and shopkeepers coming into Tahrir Square and saying, we don't want any dictator. We don't care whether he's on the right or the left. We don't care whether he's secular or Islamic. We don't care whether he's pro-American or anti-American. We don't want a dictator. And they stared him down. In fact, I would argue Obama didn't go far enough, because Obama didn't attack Morsi. He'd just gotten Morsi to help him deal with Israel and Gaza. So Obama really is very tame about Morsi's claim for absolute power. Obama doesn't get the credit. The Egyptian people get the credit for defending. And let me tell you what's so wonderful about this. Yes, the constitutional vote will still happen. And yes, I'm worried about it, as are the Egyptian people, because this vote, which is going to occur on December 15th, actually enshrines the two powers together. It combines the Muslim Brotherhood power with the military power. It actually gives the military even more power than they had under Mubarak. And that's why this constitutional vote is so concerning. And in fact, Morsi said, I'm basically taking over absolute power until this constitutional vote comes in. So the people would have no choice but to vote for it to end the absolute power. by Morsi withdrawing the absolute power, now the people can actually reject this constitution, which would be an amazing thing. They may not, because it's kind of both elements of the old regime and the new regime fighting together. But the heart of what the lesson was in Egypt, the heart of the lesson is that even if this constitution is passed, even if the military and Morsi join together, the people understand this right of revolution. Talk about We Act for We Act Radio. The people of Egypt understand they can go back to Tahrir Square. They can go back to Cairo. That anytime anyone tries to take absolute power, the people have a safety valve. They've got a way to amend the constitution. They've got an out. They just take to the streets and they can take back their country. And I don't mean to claim this is all good. I told you, I give in one cheer, maybe two cheers to people of Egypt. We're not at three cheers yet. They're hardly an established democracy. This constitution may very well come into place. We may see repression against people in the square. But the fact that Morsi backed down actually emboldens the Egyptian people and tells them, anyone who tries to take over this country is a dictator. The people themselves have the right to fight back, not with arms, not with torture or repression, by simply occupying their own square. So, I guess they put our Occupy movement to shame. The Egyptian people, way to go. We don't know how this story is going to end, but I would like to hear at least President Obama give a shout out of strong support for the Egyptian people. It's hard to do that because we've now established an alliance with Morsi. But this principle that nobody, right or left, secular or Islamic, pro-American or anti-American, nobody should be a dictator of a country. That every country has to have checks and balances and judges who are independent of a president. And the whole idea of separation of courts and the military and the president and everybody jealously looking over each other's shoulder. This is the American ideal, right? For all the problems of America, this whole idea of checks and balances, where Congress is looking over the president looking over Congress, and both of them are keeping an eye on the Supreme Court, who's watching both of them, and the media is free and they watch all three of them. This whole idea of everyone jealously watching everyone else. I got to tell you, that was the genius of the founders of the United States, because they knew that individuals want power. And the only way to keep one individual from getting power is to have another individual jealously watching that other person. Checks and balances. So again, I have hope for Egypt. I have hope for the Arab Spring. And I have hope because I think the people of Egypt are going to keep their revolution until they get some kind of democratic ruling. When we come back, I want to move on to some other countries, particularly talking about Syria. Because in Syria, well, they're in desperate shape. 40,000 innocent people have been massacred. And the question is, what are we going to do there? And how does Syria relate to Egypt? Or Libya, for that matter? How do all these countries fit together? What should the overall policy be with regard to the Arab Spring? Because I got to say, the Arab Spring, I think, is the most hopeful thing to happen in the Middle East, well, in my lifetime. Absolutely the most hopeful thing. And it's scary. Like, any birth pangs are scary, and any revolution can turn wrong. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution. Any revolution can make things worse. But revolutions can also make things better. And I think with the guiding hand of a careful president in the United States of America, we can help transform the most backward area of the world to being the most democratic, the most free. Maybe I'm too much of an optimist. What do you think? 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop on We Act Radio. If you want to know more about me, go to my website, marklevinetalk.com. Check me out on Facebook or the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park.
I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.mpca.org.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and I have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without Big Brothers Big Sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping Big Brothers Big Sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at BigBrothersBigSisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Friends, David Schuster here, and all of us at WEAC Radio are so proud of our neighbors here in Southeast D.C., especially one of our partners, The Arc. The Arc is at 1901 Mississippi Avenue Southeast. It's the home to some of Washington's best, including the Washington Ballet, the Levine School of Music, Boys and Girls Club, and the Children's Health Project. All provide a number of programs and services within the very same facility. The Arc is also home to the Arc Theater, the only theater east of the river, which hosts a variety of dance, music, and theatrical shows each year. Almost everything you could want is at the Arc, so stop by and see them. The Arc, 1901 Mississippi Avenue in Southeast. For more information, visit The Arc's website, www.thearcdc.org, or call 202-889-5901. The Arc, part of Southeast D.C.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine talking about what's going on in the Middle East. I've given a long description of what's happening in Egypt. The more severe crisis, of course, is happening in Syria. In Syria, 40,000 innocent men, women, and children have been massacred by the Assad regime. Now, I've been talking about Egyptian dictators. Mubarak was certainly a dictator. Morsi has tried to be, I think has been prevented thus far from being a dictator. But nothing that Mubarak or Morsi or Gaddafi or frankly even Saddam Hussein did rivals the evil that's being committed right now in Syria. When Barack Obama decided to join the Europeans and intervene in Libya, he said he was doing so because Muammar Gaddafi threatened to go into Benghazi and to kill, well, everyone, 500,000 people. Gaddafi famously said, if you hide in your closet, we will find you, we will kill you. And I firmly supported American intervention in Libya. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people on the left didn't support it. Some on the right didn't support it. To me, this wasn't a question of left or right. It was a question of how do we prevent a massacre. And I think Obama supported the Libyan people in exactly the right way. Not by invading, that's what we did in Iraq, that was a real mistake, but by helping them support their own revolution. Again, I would have done it sooner. And the way we succeeded in Libya, I think is a really big deal. Through U.S. air support and arming the rebels themselves took over Libya, got rid of Gaddafi, stopped the massacres. Now, Libya ain't perfect any more than Egypt or anyone else's. Libya, as we know from our attack in Benghazi, still has extremist elements. It's going to require some time to become a functionally democratic state. But what's fascinating to me is in the Libyan elections, they didn't have a choice between the old regime and an Islamic dictatorship the way they had in Egypt. They actually could choose the third way, and they did. They supported liberal democracy, pro-American liberal democracy. Imagine an Arab country, pro-American liberal democratic. That's what we got in Libya. That's why Libya is so important. Well, it's time we act in Syria. Now, this is nothing new. If you've listened to my show, you know I've been arguing for action in Syria for more than a year now. This isn't something new. We have to act in Syria for the main, for number one reason, because it's the morally right thing to do. If we were going to stop Gaddafi to save a few thousand lives, well, 40,000 people are already dead in Syria. The cities of Aleppo and Damascus are turning into rubble. In the towns, it's even worse. In the smaller towns, whole towns have been destroyed. Millions of refugees. And again, Assad is going after civilians, men, women, and children. Now, I've had representatives of the Free Syrian Army right here on this show. I will have them on again. I'm hoping to get them on actually my Inside Scoop TV show tomorrow, which you can watch on Channel 10 or in Fairfax and throughout Northern Virginia. Although if you want to just watch it on the computer, wherever you live in the world, you can watch it at marklevinetalk.com. I'm still planning that. So hopefully we'll get those fighters on. But the moral case for intervention in Syria is clear. Here you have a vicious dictatorship actively killing tens of thousands of innocent people. And if we're not going to take a stand for that, when are we going to take a stand? It's more than that, of course. It's actually easier than Egypt or Libya or Iran. It's easier because Assad is not pro-American. Assad is a Russian puppet. He's under, and an Iranian puppet. He's under the control of two of our worst enemies, right? Russia and Iran. This isn't someone we should want to see stay there as just on pure pro-American realist interests. We don't like Assad. So he's not only a vicious murderer, he's anti-American. He's anti-Israel. He's not a good guy. He's not a good guy. There are some in Israel who say, well, he's kept the front between Israel and Syria quiet for some 30 years. And that's true. He has. But he hasn't made peace either. Seems to me that no one should cry any tears over the loss of Assad. So why isn't the Obama administration intervening? Why we called for Egypt's dictator to go. We did a no-fly zone and armed the rebels in Libya. Why aren't we doing in Syria what we did in Libya? Well, Obama has called for Assad to go. That's something, I guess. And we are giving nonviolent aid to the Syrian rebels. I actually think we're doing more. I think it's going to come out that there's a secret CIA operation to help the Syrian rebels. And it's interesting. Some of the seeds for this have come out of the attack in Benghazi. See, the attack in Benghazi was not so much on the consulate that we had there, but on the CIA office that was in the annex next door. And it's come out, and it's been reported in no less than the Wall Street Journal, that that office may have been helping transform weapons, transfer them from the rebels in Libya to the rebels in Syria. If so, this is a covert operation, and I hope we're doing it. I support it. But we need to help the Syrian rebels. And Obama has mostly, at least openly, just given lip service. Now, he has said that if Assad were to use chemical weapons, then the United States would get involved. I'm glad he's drawn a red line somewhere. And I certainly hope if they do use chemical weapons, the United States comes in strongly and gets rid of the Assad regime. But it shouldn't come to that. The people of Syria are actively fighting to overthrow their dictator. And I don't support U.S. troops intervening, just like I didn't support U.S. troops in Iraq or Libya or anywhere else. U.S. troops should only go in places, well, I guess like Afghanistan, that attack us directly. But just because I don't support U.S. troops there doesn't mean we can't help. Just a no-fly zone, just arms would be enough. Frankly, they are getting arms, the rebels in Syria, from Saudi Arabia and from some other sources. I actually think they're getting arms covertly from us, though I can't prove it. We'll find out later on. But a no-fly zone would be terrific because the Syrian army, the Syrian Air Force, is using the Syrian planes to attack the Syrian people. Think about how scary that is. Can you imagine if the United States military used our planes to strafe Washington, D.C. and New York and Cleveland? It's unthinkable. It's unthinkable. That's what's happening in Syria. The Syrian military is using their weapons against their own people. And I would love to see a no-fly zone set up. Now, if you ask people in the Obama administration, on air or off air, why we haven't been more active in Syria, they will tell you they're afraid of the elements in the Syrian resistance. They're afraid of Al-Qaeda. They're afraid of extremists. They're afraid that the Syrian resistance will turn to, well, again, follow my pattern, Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They're afraid that it will end up in anti-American fundamentalist Islamic dictatorship, or it'll end up in some kind of civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. Well, to understand that, you have to understand a little bit of the history of Syria. And I want to tell you why I disagree, why I don't think that's going to happen, and why I actually think that the less we help, the more likely it is that that doomsday scenario will happen. In other words, if we do nothing, we may end up with Islamic fundamentalist power in Syria. If we do help, I think we're less likely to end up there. And I'm going to explain when we come back. 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. This is the Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. You're welcome to add your 2 cents. You don't have to agree or disagree. Just tell me what you think. We'll be right back right after this.
Listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery,
Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
I'm Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico. Last year, my state became the 12th state to allow medical use of marijuana by patients who are seriously ill. Some people were surprised that a Republican governor supports medical marijuana, but I'm hardly alone. Groups like the American College of Physicians, American Nurses Association, and American Public Health Association have all acknowledged the medical value of marijuana. New research about medical marijuana is coming out almost every day, showing remarkable potential in all sorts of serious conditions, including cancer, AIDS, and chronic pain. But some in government still want to put politics and ideology ahead of public health. To learn more about medical marijuana and what you can do to help, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thanks.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine talking about what's going on in the Middle East and right now focusing on Syria. So I've been arguing for more than a year that we need to do something about Syria. Not invade, but simply have a no-fly zone like we did in Libya. Arm the rebels. Give them a chance to succeed. The president has been resisting this. Why? Certainly he doesn't want to see 40,000 innocent people massacred. Certainly he doesn't. He wants a pro-American regime in Syria. But the fear is that Syria will erupt in civil war. And let's face it, there are lots and lots of different peoples in Syria. The majority of Syria, probably 80% or more, is of the Sunni Muslim group, Sunni Muslim sect, I guess you might want to call it. That's the majority Arab Muslim group. It's the one in Egypt and all across North Africa and Saudi Arabia and the Palestinians and Jordan, and they're all Sunni. There was a great split in the Islamic world following the death of Muhammad between the Sunnis and the Shiites. I won't get into the whole, look it up on Wikipedia. You can read all about the succession and the brother-in-law of the son-in-law of Muhammad and all the details. But the point is there's two very disparate groups of Muslims, and they often fight each other. I mean, the Iran-Iraq war, brutal. I mean, a million people died in that war. 1982 was largely between the, Sunni government of Iraq and the Shia living in Iran. Iran, by the way, is a majority Shia state. That was run by a Sunni dictator. Well, Syria is a majority Sunni state run by a Shia dictator. Really, the group that he's from, the Alawis, are not even exactly the typical Shiites. They're a different minority. But the heart of what you need to understand is that Assad is from a minority religion within Syria that has full power. And obviously the concern is if the Sunnis, who are the majority of the state, take power, the concern is there's going to be some retribution against the Alawis. Now, you could argue, well, some of them deserve it. After all, they've been in power for 40 years and had gotten special privileges, and that's true. But remember, there's all kinds of Alawi, just like there's all kinds of Sunni. They're not all involved with the Assad government. I have no sympathy for those involved in the Assad government, but I do have sympathy for ordinary people. And there are other minorities as well. There's Christians. There's Druze. There's even a tiny Jewish community. There's all kinds in Syria, and obviously the United States would like to see a Syria where all religions, all peoples are respected. We do not want to see an Islamic dictatorship. We certainly don't want to see Al-Qaeda in control. And the people who are fighting the Assad regime include not just liberal Democrats, not just the Free Syrian Army, not just people that you and I might support, but also some of the worst. Includes Al-Qaeda and includes extremists. And the fear is that those extremists will take power. Now, I have had members of the Free Syrian Army on my show, and I have a lot of faith in them, I got to say. And some might say, well, Mark, you're being naive, but I've heard their heartfelt pleas. I really have little doubt that they want the kind of Syria that I'd like to see, one where there's a democracy, where no religion is mistreated, whether you're Sunni or Alawi or Christian or Druze, where everyone has freedom of religion and freedom to vote, and a true democratic Syria. But the concern of the Obama administration is, well, we don't quite know who these rebels are. They're a disparate group of people, as you would think they have to be, right? They came up organically, much like Libya. It's not like there was a, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria was sitting there waiting to take over like it was in Egypt. These are just ordinary people trying to defend their own lives, trying to defend their families from massacre. And so you can understand why they might be a little disorganized, why they don't have weapons. If a, you know, the government started attacking us here in the United States, we wouldn't be ready to resist. I don't know, maybe some militias would. I really shouldn't talk like that because it's not going to happen in the United States, and it's clearly just a thought experiment. I don't want to scare people. But the point is that ordinary people living their ordinary lives are not likely to be able to quickly and easily form a militia to defend themselves, and they might disagree. Well, after a year of warfare in Syria, the Syrian Free Army is getting better. The militias are getting better. They actually control whole swaths of the Syrian countryside. Probably more than half of the square miles in Syria are now controlled by the rebels. They still don't have the two major cities, Aleppo or Damascus. And the Syrian military is still strafing them from the skies with Syrian planes. But there's a lot of defections. And I would argue that the tide has turned. I would argue that at this point, I always thought the rebels were going to win. I thought that a year ago, but most commentators did not. At this point, I think the majority of commentators realize, I think Assad realizes, or he should, that his days are numbered. I don't know whether the rebels are going to win in a day, a week, or more a month, but I think well within a year, we're going to see a new Syria. A Syria where, unfortunately, they still have to bury tens of thousands of innocent people that are murdered, but that will come out of this, come out of the ashes. And the question is, what kind of Syria will we see? And just like with Egypt, just like with Libya, this is America's chance to really put a step forward for liberal democracy. Because there's always going to be these tensions in the Arab world, always these tensions between these secular dictatorship, military, repressive regimes, like Assad, like Gaddafi, like Saddam Hussein, like Mubarak, and these fundamentalist Islamic grassroots groups, but ones that mistreat women and do not believe in freedom of religion and don't believe that Christians should have rights and are anti-Israel, things like, well, the Taliban or what happened in Iran, the fundamentalist government of Iran, or arguably the Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas or the people that were fighting back in Iraq. There's always going to be this tension. And we always, I think, always have to support a third group. This is a false idea with some on the right saying we have to support these military dictatorships, secular ones, because otherwise we end up with these Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. And then there's some on the left that say, well, no, you got to support the Islamic fundamentalist terrorists because the secular military is so terrible. And I say, no, they're both awful. They're both awful. We have to support ordinary people, students and shopkeepers and people who want to live in a democratic country where all religions are safe, where you can be openly Christian or openly Shia, openly Alawi, openly Sunni, and where women have rights, rights to vote, rights to wear what they please, not naked in the streets, but definitely not burqas. but they had the right to express themselves. To me, there's just these two minimums. These two minimums. Freedom of religion. Well, three. Well, four. Freedom of religion is one. Freedom for women is the second one. The third would be freedom of the press. That's real important. You don't want press shut down because they disagree with the government. And the last, of course, is democracy, is voting, is actually choosing their leadership. These basic, what you might call First Amendment rights in the United States, I think are universal freedoms. I don't think these are cultural. I do not believe that say, well, yeah, okay, freedom for women, that makes sense in a Western context, but Arabs don't believe in it. No, I disagree. I think human freedom is universal. Now, I am not saying the United States should control these governments. I am not saying the United States should impose its will on these governments. I'm not saying that these governments will agree with the United States. But I think if we have basic democracy and human rights and freedom of religion and freedom for women, freedom of the press, then I think these governments will be less likely to be anti-American. It's tough because I realize that the street could get angry. There are certainly people in Gaza who support, for example, war with Israel. But I don't know that they're the majority. They may be. I just happen to think a democracy is much less likely to start an aggressive war. So President Obama, I'd like to see you do more for Syria. Maybe in covert aid, but you're already doing it. I really think you are. I like to think that you are. Also, let's get a no-fly zone. Let's start getting it ready. Let's be ready to go. The Assad regime may fall any minute. And I want it to be said that we were on the side of the Syrian people. I want, just like the Libyans are very grateful for American aid, I want the Syrians to be grateful. And I don't want it to be, oh, well, Libya has oil and Syria doesn't. That's why we're in Libya. We have a chance to take horror going on in Syria right now and turn it into a positive benefit for the Syrian people, for the American people, and for the world. This is an opportunity, President Obama, and I realize that most Americans don't want to intervene, don't know the details, are tired of foreign wars, want troops to come home. And I respect that, and I certainly don't want to see American troops there. This is not, you know, I didn't support the war in Iraq. Not because I didn't want to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but because I didn't want us to do it. It seems to me that if a people hates their dictator enough, it's up to them to overthrow their dictator. We can help, but we cannot lead the way. It's time for us to get involved in Syria. Conscience demands it. 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. You can find out more about me at marklevinetalk.com or on the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. Agree or disagree, I'd like to hear from you. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back, right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello world, it's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage, and that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement. Movement of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without Big Brothers Big Sisters.
I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything, at a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to WEACT Radio, 1480 AM. If you want to dial in, 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. I want to talk at length about the Middle East because, well, I don't think these issues get talked about very much. We see all these things go on around the world, and yet we, I think, don't follow them so much when we're focusing on what's happening here in the United States. Look, this is an old question. As I was bringing up before, the question of United States interference, intervention in the world, there are some on the left that say we should never be involved in the world. There's some on the right that say we should be involved, but only to support pro-American dictatorship governments. Sometimes they, on the right, they'll say they want democracy, but in the day, they really want a pro-American government. To me, it's not the pro-American, and it's not the leave these regimes alone. It's helping people choose their own leaders. It seems to me that all over the world, we look at what the United Nations does. The United Nations doesn't represent the people of the world. Why? Because its governments don't represent their people. When China votes, they're voting, one person is voting for a billion people, but the billion people didn't choose that leader. So I do believe in helping democracy around the globe, and I don't think that's a right-wing or a left-wing thing. To me, it's a human rights thing. And though we should help the people in Syria, we should help the people in Egypt and Libya, and it's time to change the American perception. Now, it's hard because, let's face it, there's a lot of anti-Israel feeling in the Arab world. Some of it justified. Most of it, I would argue, unjustified. But it's based on the fact that, well, they basically feel that Israel, that the Jew, there shouldn't be a Jewish state. I'm a believer that every state in the world, wherever there's a majority population, they should have a right to control their own destiny. So, you know, Syria should be a majority Sunni state because the majority are Sunnis. Now, there should be Shia rights and Druze rights and Christian rights, but the Sunnis should be in charge. In Iran, the Shia will mostly be in charge, but there should be rights for women and rights for minorities, absolutely. In Israel, the Jews are going to be in charge, but there should be rights for Christians, rights for Muslims, rights for Druze, and there are. In the Palestinian territories, Sunni Muslims will be in control, should be in control, but there should be rights for everybody else as well. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world. It's very hard sometimes. You know, should the Basques have a country? You know, I'm okay with that. Should the Kurds have a country? Absolutely. The Kurdish people who live in Turkey and Syria and Iran and Iraq are mistreated by everybody. I certainly believe that every people that's large enough to actually have a state and has its own culture, its own religion, its own language should have that right. Now, whether or not there should be two or three or six Sunni Arab states, I don't take a strong stand on that. But should there be at least one? Absolutely. Should there be at least one Kurdish state? Absolutely. Should there be at least one Jewish state? Absolutely. Perhaps no one has known suffering as much as the Jewish people, particularly in the Middle East. But these issues get wrapped up in our own identities, and people tend to support their side, and they don't tend to think about anyone else. And I guess that's human. I guess it's human for us to support ourselves over our families over our neighbors and our neighbors over the town next door, our religion over another people's religion, and yes, our nation over another nation. I guess that's as human as can be. Heck, we have people who argue strongly over their sports teams. And that's really meaningless. How much more do people, Americans, humans, all the world over, fight over religious battles and so forth? But I think in the recent war between Israel and Hamas, Israel showed a fundamental decency that the world needs to recognize and respect. I know of no country in the world other than Israel that fights a war and prior to bombing, necessary bombs to stop rockets and missiles from raining on Israeli cities. Actually, Israel dropped leaflets over civilian areas saying,